Life sure gets busy, doesn't it? Well, we understand. With all the certifications you have, finding the right kind of continuing education that fits your schedule can be a real challenge. That's where the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription comes in. For less than $5 a month, the FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription gives you top-notch accredited CE while you listen. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information or to sign up today. The FlightBridge Ed podcast subscription, another way we're being your partner in discovery.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the FlightBridge Ed Podcast. Mike Verkess sitting in today with Eric and Ashley Bauer. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Thank
awesome.
You.
We're doing good.
We're sitting here at the NTI conference in Orlando, Florida. What an amazing place. We've had just such a great response to folks coming up to the booth, learning about FlightBridge Ed. And so that's why we're all together. So while we're here, we thought we should do a nightmare case series podcast. And this one's going to be interesting. We don't want to give you too much details. We actually just want to get right in the case. And we're going to start it, and we'll talk about it in a couple phases. The first phase will sort of be that pre-hospital phase. We'll learn a little bit about the scenario, what's been going on, and then we'll actually follow this patient through the hospital. We'll look at labs. We'll talk about x-rays and CTs, everything else that has gone along with this. So let's just, Eric, you want to walk us through sort of at least the initial bit of information so we can kind of find out what's going on with this case here.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are dispatched to a 16-year-old female that was found unresponsive by family. Basically, they went in to wake her up this morning at about 7 a.m. and because she didn't come out for breakfast or for school.
Yeah.
And she was last seen last night. They found her foaming at the mouth, unresponsive. Immediately called EMS. Parents say that they had an argument the evening before, and she was last seen at 2000 hours. So
okay, what time is it right now? 7 a.m.-ish?
Yeah.
All right, well, this
about 11 hours.
So this is where I like to think about initial management. What are you thinking as a provider when you go on there? So you got a lot of telltale information that could potentially either lead you down the primrose path of this is what's going on, or this could be easy for people to go astray and just assume one thing or another. So a 16-year-old argument with the parents, the things I want to know is have they done this before? Have they had any suicidal ideation? What's the behavior been like, right? I mean, that's the first thing I think that's important to know so you can sort of get down that path. So do we know anything about history or what's been going on with her?
No, not a lot of history, really. No previous suicide attempts.
So other medical problems either. Nothing, no seizures, no history of neuro stuff. So that's, this for me, this is what I'm thinking. I'm going, obviously she's got altered mental status. She's unresponsive. I mean, is this somebody that I would have to look at RSIing? I don't know exactly what she's presenting like on scene. Like, does she have, what's her respiratory rate? What's her blood pressure? What's her heart rate? What's her end tidal? There's a lot of things that are going to sort of make me decide how we're going to jump in and interact with this. So
initial assessment, EMS found her breathing 4 times a minute. Blood pressure initially was 64 over 38.
All right.
Heart rate of 48, Glasgow Coma Scale of 3.
Okay.
They immediately tried some Narcan. So we'll say 2 milligrams of Narcan. And there actually was a slight improvement in respiratory rate to 10 per minute. So it increased by 6. So let's stop there. I want to discuss that.
I'd like to discuss that a little bit too.
Yeah. obviously, I just did a podcast on the whole black or white 50 Shades of Gray. Yep. And I really emphasize, and that is a big, big point. And I think that I'm very sensitive to that specific medication. I think it's overused. It's given in situations like this all the time. I think this is an example where it worked.
Did it?
I don't
know.
Did
it work? I don't know.
I mean,
we'll find out.
Not really sure why it worked, knowing the case. But I think it's so easy. You have somebody unresponsive. You have a respiratory rate that's low like that. 16-year-old female. Is it the wrong thing to do? I don't know. Is it the right thing to do? I don't know. I mean, well, I think you're going to get varying opinions.
I think you will get varying opinions. And I think the reality is that we almost have to strip it back a little bit even more, because if you look, and then going right back to what you just mentioned, is that 50 Shades of Grey, I guarantee you that if you probably looked at the protocols, the EMS protocols where this case came from, they probably have an unresponsive algorithm, right? And included in that algorithm is check a blood sugar, give Narcan, do all these things that the old coma cocktail that we used to give back in the old days. But if there is no reason to believe based on, that's just a blood pressure of, what was it, 60? That doesn't jive. It's just as weird.
What do you think, Ashley?
I mean, I can see both sides as well. I think just throwing Narcan at somebody that you have absolutely no reason for is not warranted. But at the same time, a 16-year-old had a fight with her parents, now unresponsive. Absolutely, I'm going to go down that road that I think she may have taken something. I mean,
and I think that's common. That's what people are going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's risk versus reward. And we're not saying that that was the wrong approach. And I agree.
Yeah,
it's one of those things where, you know, you probably need to do it in that situation.
Yeah.
But I think you also have to, you get a clinical picture of how somebody is presenting to you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you have to try to gather. And in the field, it's hard, right? It's different than in the hospital. Well, it's probably not much different, but I mean, you have to get that 10,000 foot view of what's their past medical history. What are you seeing right now? Like, is there any reason to believe that she has taken heroin or an opioid?
So pupils. What do the pupils look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to it. And so, but anyway, so that's just another little point of our 50 Shades of Grey that it's just interesting to have a discussion about. Again, not that it was wrong, but it's worth talking about.
Sure. So they made the determination that they needed RSI. We're not going to go into all of that, right?
Okay.
We'll just say the rapid sequence intubation
process
went fine.
I'm hoping they, resuscitated her a little bit.
Yeah.
Yep.
And at the facility, now blood pressure is 52 over 26. Heart rate is 52. Pupils are noted to be 2 millimeters and fixed. Afebrile. GCS remains 3, even with the improvement in respiratory rate after the Narcan.
So was that after or before the RSI, or do we know how they?
What, GCS?
What in respiratory rate?
The respiratory rate initially was prior to RSI.
Right.
Do you have something to add?
No.
Okay. Heart rate, no murmurs. There's no ectopy. Still narrow complex sinus brady. OG tube is placed. Really normal stomach contents are retrieved.
So no pill fragments, no nothing weird. I mean, obviously that's the other thing you think about, right? Did they take medication somehow?
Yeah. They gave a standard fluid bolus, and they started her on Levofit.
Okay.
Okay, so Levofit at 8 mics per minute.
All right.
And also decided to give an amp of calcium chloride.
All right. So what happened with that?
So no increase in MAP, and then they obviously got the labs. So I'll let Ashley jump in on the labs and discuss. We'll go through and discuss the labs, the initial assessment from the provider perspective.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so she had several abnormal labs. First off, she had a white blood cell count of 26.2. So yeah, it would automatically kind of make you question where that elevated white blood cell count is coming. Initial H&H was 10.9 and 32.8, and a platelet count of 291. Yeah, whatever, nothing significant there. She did have an elevated creatinine at 2.91. Normal creatinine, usually around 0.8 to 1.3. So was a little bit elevated for whatever reason, unknown at this time. As far as electrolytes go, really the only abnormality was a sodium of 128. Everything else was pretty unremarkable. The other things that kind of stood out, she had an elevated AST at 2,919. The high normal of an AST is around 30 or so. And then an ALT, which is 1,680, with the high normal being around 30 as well. Her ammonia was also elevated at 78. with a normal high being around 45. As far as other labs, elevated lactic acid at 7.1. She did have elevated ethanol levels at 0.185. And then her CK was greater than 12,000, which is a little bit alarming as well, with the high normal of that being about 200. Her urine drug screen was negative. Aspirin and acetaminophen were both negative as well. Initial troponin was 0.67.
All right. So that's a lot of information. So let's go back up to the white blood cell count. Why is that count so high? Is that a stress inflammatory response? What can that be?
Yeah, I mean, being that there's no other obvious signs of infection to make you think that that would be elevated due to infection, I would assume that that's elevated in response to the amount of stress that she is under at this time. So I would go more on the side of an acute stress response versus an infectious process.
Okay. All right. Obviously, creatinine was elevated. Patient could just be super dry, maybe acute renal failure, or do you think that that is also related to more of a stress?
No, I do think the creatinine, it's simply just given the creatinine alone, I would think a dehydration. Then we're also concerned about, what kind of transpired between the time that this girl was last seen and the time that she was found. Why would that creatinine all of a sudden be so elevated, especially if she had no medical history that would lead us down to any kidney problems. The other concerning thing is once we got the CK back at greater than 12,000, now you're a little bit concerned about the rhabdo, the elevated CK with the acute renal failure. Why would this girl have all these elevated numbers like that?
Okay, and then obviously the AST, ALT being skyrocketed, the increased ammonia. So there's definitely liver involvement.
Right. Right.
And then an alcohol level of 0.18, right? So.
Right. And then you think about liver involvement, drugs involved with that. The first one that should come to mind is the acetaminophen,
that's what I was thinking. Was it?
Yeah, absolutely
normal.
Did she
take something together? I mean,
right.
or just go in the bathroom and hodgepodge a bunch of different stuff?
Right.
I mean, poly overdose? I don't know.
So it's still, you're still kind of up in the air because the acetaminophen was negative. So it's not an acetaminophen toxicity type state. So still kind of unsure exactly what's going on here.
So I think the big thing with this, was there any information at this point from family or anything that could be derived based on what the potential medication that she took? Because when we go back to the original facility treatment, one of the things that sticks out to me is they gave an amp of calcium chloride.
Yeah.
Now, we know that we can give some calcium. I think when I think chloride, even though I see EMS agencies all over the country use chloride really should be used in a central line, right? I mean, you infiltrate central, calcium
for sure,
chloride.
You know what? It's back to medication shortages. I can tell you that we had to switch to chloride about a year ago.
Sure.
Because we can't get gluconate.
Yeah.
It's tough out there, right? And hospitals are in the same boat. But I totally agree with you.
So was it given because of a hemodynamic support type of a thought process?
Yeah.
Or was there a thought process that this is a calcium channel blocker overdose? Right.
Yeah, and I think initially, the parents said that, the girl had no prior history whatsoever, no psychological issues, no previous suicide attempts. She's not on any medications whatsoever. So, aside from them saying our only concern was that we had an argument last night, pretty bad argument before she went to bed, there really wasn't any other information given. And so I think probably that the calcium was given more for the hemodynamic support versus actually having a working knowledge of what may be going on underneath this.
Because if you think about it, she, from a hemodynamic perspective, she looks just like somebody that would be struggling from a calcium channel, right? So she's got some bradycardia. She's got all the signs and symptoms, but these labs don't make any sense.
Right.
Right? I mean,
No. So, I mean, I think that that's the big thing. So at what point do you start isolating your focus? If this is a calcium channel blocker overdose, continue to work up. Obviously, they started her on Levofed, gave volume. So where do we go from there?
So, you know, we're kind of still at this crossroads here about why is this girl presenting the way she is? What is causing all of these things to occur? So then the questioning goes back to the parents. And it was asked, you know, are you guys on any medications that could potentially be in the home? The mother says no, you know, nothing whatsoever, but that the dad is on some blood pressure pills. So, you know, we asked the dad, who says that he is on amlodipine and clonidine for blood pressure.
Aha.
Bam.
Right. He did not take his medication that morning. He says he normally keeps it in the kitchen on the counter to remind himself every morning to take his medication. So they weren't really able to give the information at that time about, you know, pills missing, things like that. Dad was leaving at that time to go get the medication to ensure, you know, if that's really the cause of this, but that's kind of what the thought process is now that we know the exact medications, right, that he's on.
Yeah, so how many did they find missing?
So ultimately, once the dad got back, they found 18 pills missing of the amlodipine, which is about 180 milligrams of that medication. The clonidine, he was a little bit unsure of. He only takes that medication on an as-needed basis, and it's an older prescription, so he really could not accurately say whether anything was missing or not.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take a pause for a second. I like to call it the tactical pause, and let's recap everything that we've talked about so far. So we had a 16-year-old, unresponsive, at home, intubated in the field, brought in, initially unclear about what exactly was going on. We did get some information from the family that the dad does take a calcium channel blocker. The clonidine, we weren't exactly sure if he took it or not. Like we mentioned, we finally decided that's the road we're going down, calcium channel blocker.
Right.
Right?
Right. Okay. So based on all that information and her labs, it's pretty evident that you're dealing with a calcium channel blocker. So I think we could probably transition now into talking about the patho behind the calcium channel blockers, which would make a little bit more sense on why she had some of the abnormal labs that she did.
Yeah, perfect.
So I think the thing to point out is when you look at calcium channel blocker overdose, verapamil and diltiazem, those are the most lethal calcium channel blockers. And correct me if I'm wrong, pills, the medications that she took are along the same lines. Is that correct?
Right. Yes.
So what I'm understanding is that not all calcium channel blockers are equal. So in an overdose situation, some can be worse than others. Is that right?
Right.
And what is that? Is that based on the pharmacodynamics of the medication?
The pharmacokinetics and the way that the medication is broken down in the body. And yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of that we don't necessarily need to go into here. But yeah, in simpler terms, there are some worse calcium channel blockers than others in overdose situations.
Okay. So what are the worst ones to have?
So that's where you're going to look at verapamil, diltiazem. Those are very, very common. Obviously, we used to use a lot of verapamil way back in the day.
Absolutely.
And that was always a scary route to go down.
Yeah.
You know, we actually pre-treated. With calcium.
Yeah, you and I.
Yeah,
and we back
treated
in the day.
One box, essentially.
An amp of calcium, and then we give them the verapamil.
Yeah. So I think we just have to understand, remember, calcium is so, so important for cardiac myocytes, for vascular smooth muscle tone. And now you have a calcium channel blocker overdose, you're going to have an excessive amount of negative inotropy. You're going to have an excessive amount of negative chronotropy, and you're going to have that AV ventricular node blockade. So you get all aspects that are going to reduce cardiac output.
And that's exactly what we saw in this world.
Yeah.
She had bradycardia, profound hypotension. The list goes on and on. She had them all.
So you're going to have a huge decrease in afterload. You're going to have a systemic hypotension. And, you know, that overall coronary vasodilation is going to, you know, it's just a catastrophic reduction.
And it actually starts to make a little more sense when you think about how dependent our organs are with MAP, right? So at that organ level, the, you know, blood flow is not pulsatile. It literally is so dependent on having a mean arterial pressure sufficient enough to actually support the function of those organs. And then when we started talking about Why are the ALTs and the ASTs screwed up? Why are the kidneys screwed up? Well, my guess is that it probably has to do with the fact that these organs are not being perfused.
Yeah, so Ashley, do you want to go into some more physiology and I guess the pathophysiology of how this medication is causing havoc on her?
Yeah, so there's a few other things. We saw that she had the elevated liver enzymes, and when it comes to the calcium channel blockers in an overdose situation, those elevated liver enzymes are secondary to the ischemic changes of the liver that occurs, as well as the rhabdo that we talked about. She had the elevated CK, and then with the acute renal failure, which kind of led us down the rhabdo route. What you can also see in these individuals is an elevation in the glucose because of that calcium channel blocker overdose. The calcium channel blockers actually block the receptors on the beta cells, which prevents that release of insulin. And so that's where you'll see that elevated glucose secondary to that. The other thing I think it's important to talk about here is the elevated troponin. Kind of where that may be coming from.
Yeah, and I think the troponin, we always look at troponin, obviously, in the MI setting. We won't spend a lot of time on this, but this is more based on the stress response, right? This is not ischemic in nature. And just like we saw the increase in white blood cell count and other areas, other labs being elevated, lactate, again, a stress response indicator, that troponin, in my opinion, is not relative to ischemia, but more stress. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just the demand that's being placed on the heart that's leading to that increase. The facility has given her IV fluid boluses. They have her on norepinephrine being titrated, and they're still not able to overcome those blocking effects of those calcium channel blockers.
So when you look at calcium channel blocker overdose, the treatment used to be focused on calcium chloride infusion or administration, I should say. And the whole insulin infusion, the high-dose insulin, was more of a late-stage type of a thought process. They've recognized now that insulin is so essential in that inotropic support. Obviously, she's been volume resuscitated. She's on that Levofed infusion, and she still has a very poor perfusion status with a MAP less than 60. So the facility actually started an insulin bolus. They start with an insulin bolus of 1 unit per kilo. She was a 52-kilo 16-year-old female, so they went 52 units. And Ashley, am I correct to say this is going to be a short-acting insulin on that bolus?
Yes. Okay. Yes, this will be short-acting insulin.
And then because she's getting such a large dose of insulin, you've got to start her on some sugar. And there's different protocols. You could go 25 grams IV push. I think that we're getting away from that. They went more of a conservative D10, which I think is much better. And they gave a 100 mil per hour dose of D10. Then when you look at specifically the infusion of insulin, is that going to be a long-acting insulin? Is that correct?
No, that's still short-acting.
Still short-acting. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's my mistake. So short acting, and that's going to be at 0.5 to 1 unit per kilo per hour, and they titrate that every 30 minutes to effect. Now, they can escalate that all the way up to a maximum, and this is, again, a variable based on your area, what the physician or mid-level wants to do, but anywhere from 5 to 15 units per kilo per hour. So you think about going all the way to 15 units per kilo per hour, we're talking massive, massive doses. So obviously, serial blood glucose checks have to be done. And as Ashley stated, just because of the liver involvement that we've seen, we've already seen the labs, the AST, ALT, the ammonia level. She has liver involvement. That calcium channel blocker overdose causes insulin resistance. And so that's going to cause a hyperglycemia. Is that correct? Yeah. So
what kind of sugars are we talking? What would be a reasonable sugar for these people to have? Is it going to be in the 600s? Is it going to be...
No,
is
I don't
it gonna
think
be
you
sort
normally
of the,
see
wouldn't
that
be,
high.
Wouldn't be nothing that big.
No, just more elevations in general. We're not talking like 400 or 500,
gotcha.
But they may be 200
gotcha.
Plus, and
okay.
In a non-diabetic patient.
So, Ashley, what type of response did they see from the inotropic support based on insulin?
So interestingly, after they started that insulin drip, she did have a significant increase in her MAP of greater than 65. The EKG, the 12 lead at that time, showed a sinus rhythm with a heart rate of 76 and a QRS duration of 92.
Yeah, so that's a big improvement.
Yeah, yeah. Significant improvement just based on the insulin administration alone.
Wow. So where do we go from here? Obviously, patient is admitted, taken to the ICU, and let's follow up and kind of talk about high points in her care and how she progressed, whether that's a positive or negative.
So day two, she continued to remain unresponsive. She did actually have a worsening anion gap metabolic acidosis. She had an increase in her anion gap of up to 20. At that time, she had a decrease in her bicarb from 22 originally down to 16. Creatinine continued to increase. She was now at 5.12 on the second day compared to, she was at 2.91 on the first day. So a significant increase really on that kidney function. No urine output. She had to have emergent dialysis at that time. They were able to wean her off the norepinephrine due to the insulin, but really significant decline continues. And that no urine output, I think that should be mentioned, that that's going to be secondary to that acute tubular necrosis and the rhabdo that she was experiencing.
Yeah, so a few things. So high anion gap metabolic acidosis, that number as far as a uncorrected or corrected is variable based on the hospital. So I know Ashley's hospital she works at, an uncorrected high anion gap is going to be anything greater than 12. A corrected, depending on, again, the literature is anywhere. Some hospitals say anything greater than 15. Some places say greater than 20. I don't really know what the right answer is. A high anion gap just is a reflection of
the severity of the acidosis.
And I think the one thing we have to understand, and I was just reading one of Paul Merrick's articles or chapters and always learned something, and we were on the flight, is that you can have a perfect ABG, but you have a high anion gap with a perfect ABG, that is still an indication of metabolic acidosis. The ABG just says not shown that reflection yet, right? So that is an early, early indicator. And I think that shows us the value of actually being able to calculate an anion gap with a specific comprehensive metabolic panel and having those labs available. Reminder that bicarb that we see in that formula is the CO2 on that comprehensive metabolic panel. That is not the bicarb on the ABG. Because remember, 95% of all CO2 is carried in bicarb, and that's the way that they can identify that serum bicarb level. So we have those labs, and I think that is something that's important to know, that even with a normal ABG, high anion gap is a reflection of metabolic acidosis. Do you have anything you want to add?
Perfect. No, not really. We'll just kind of wrap this case up, and then maybe we could hit on a few more talking points. So over the next couple of days, she did have an actual decrease in her anion gap down to 13. Lactic acid started decreasing down to 2.2. Her CK was decreasing. She was able to come off that insulin drip and the D10. She continued to be unresponsive, however. And then she started beginning to experience periods of hypoxia, upper 70s despite high FiO2, high levels of PEEP. And she actually went into ARDS. And then within a few days, she did develop cardiac arrest, and they were unable to resuscitate her. So death was called at that time.
So, yeah, not all of our cases end up obviously positive. And I think, on the Flight Reject podcast, usually we look at these cases, and I think this is just a sad reminder of everybody that listens. You've seen these cases. Even though you have somebody that's 16, very healthy, these overdoses are lethal, right? Especially when you have the early liver involvement. Like when I saw that in those labs, that's an ominous sign. All right, Ashley, why don't you take us through our treatment algorithm and walk us through our core kind of points. Obviously, maybe on another podcast, we could go through and look at differential diagnosis and going through our different medications that we could see, whether that's a tricyclic, whether that's a beta blocker,
right?
Sodium channel blockers, etc. But I think obviously very early on we identify this as calcium channel blocker, and so let's go through those high points.
Right. So yeah, I mean, I think it's important to start with, once you've identified that it is a calcium channel blocker, You know, we look at our MAP. If you have a MAP less than 65, that's where we really want to consider giving that calcium chloride as IV bolus. If you have a MAP that's greater than 65, of course, those patients are not as severe at that point, so you can consider calcium chloride infusion. Usually that's 20 milligrams per kilogram per hour as an infusion rate. The next thing you have to consider is the use of pressors, like norepinephrine, phenylephrine, whatever your choice may be. I think it's important to remember here that you do have to be careful when you use those pressors and in what situation, because they are going to increase the myocardial demand overall. And so you can actually worsen that cardiogenic shock state that they may already be in. Of course, in this situation, they really didn't have any choice at that point. When they started the pressor, they didn't realize that it was a calcium channel blocker overdose. We kind of weren't at that point yet. But it is something to keep in the back of your mind to consider before using. You know, for bradycardias less than 60, you can always consider external pacing. I'll get your guys' opinion. I think that's going to depend on the perfusion status of your patient. A heart rate of 58 doesn't necessarily need external pacing.
Yeah, especially on a 16-year-old.
Well, yeah, I don't think it would be intuitive to a paramedic in that situation, but you know, given the fact that the rest of her hemodynamics are so screwed up, I don't know if they would think of that. You know, I think they would probably go with the fluid and maybe pressors early on.
I think so too.
Even push dose pressors to at least sort of try to help that a little bit, at least during the intubation process that we were talking about. So, but even atropine, right, which I'm sure you'll cover in a second here, like in a 16-year-old, it's just,
yeah,
that's where you really have to, that clinical acumen has to be super strong, because I think there's,
right,
it's such a train wreck. It's like, where do you really begin, right? And
right,
so I don't know how intuitive it would be in that moment to think about atropine or pacing when you've got an airway problem, you've got a MAP problem, there's so many things that are happening. So
yeah, no, I completely agree. I don't think it would be intuitive. I think your focus is going to be on other things. And if I was put in the same situation, it would probably be the same way. There's no way that, you know, whoever transported could have known that she potentially overdosed on calcium channel blockers to even make them go down that route. But good point.
Especially
anyway,
responding to the Narcan.
Yeah, which
even
is
though,
even
still
though, weird to
you know,
me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we kind of have started with basing our treatment on the actual MAP of the patient. So if you continue to have a MAP that's less than 65, that's where you would really start to consider initiating high dose insulin. Starting that dextrose with that blood sugar at least 200, you want to prevent that precipitous drop in glucose with the administration of insulin.
All right, so now that we've covered the case, we know the outcome of the case, we know, you know, the big emphasis on this case is obviously differential, getting through and identifying, hey, we have this type of medication overdose, identifying the algorithm, start with airway. We moved all the way down that. Obviously, the big change here is that high dose insulin, and we covered that, I think, pretty well. Let's do some questions and answers, because I think that's something that is important, right?
Yeah. So I've got a question about calcium channel blockers then. So early on in an overdose situation, the mainstay of the treatment is calcium. Calcium, it's an amp of calcium gluconate, whatever it happens to be, chloride. And so the question is, why doesn't that just continue on through the progression of this overdose? Because, I mean, at some point, you would think that we have overcome the overdose, right? But really, I guess now that I'm thinking about it, is there's probably... What, I guess once that's addressed, right? There's no reason to keep that going.
Yeah, kind of. So in the beginning, we do focus on the calcium chloride to overcome those calcium channel blocking effects.
Right.
The problem in this case is the secondary insults that led to death. So you have the initial overdose in the calcium channel blockers, which actually the effects of that is within hours. So it's a pretty quick onset. And had she received this treatment earlier on, it likely would have been...
Maybe it would have been a different story. I mean,
right,
who knows,
a totally
right?
different outcome.
Yeah.
But because this was allowed to go on as long as it did, by no fault, you know, of,
yeah, of course,
of anyone's, you have such massive secondary insults. that basically that really led to her overall demise.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions?
Nope.
No, yet.
Nope. I mean, I really think for me that was the big take home was, you know, if you suspect it early on, you got to get that calcium on board to really prevent some of these, because it's just an incredible case with a, you know, just a super sad outcome, and just realizing really how important. I mean, we talk about MAP and we talk about this stuff all the time. This is a perfect example of when your MAP is affected. Just those, it's just a waterfall of downstream problems that the patient's going to have, and ultimately leads to their death. So,
yeah, a couple of things I do want to add, you know, that we talked about. So we talked about the whole cardiac, you know, the bradycardia side of things. I mean, I think atropine is the ACLS algorithm is so quick to point out, hey, symptomatic bradycardia, consider atropine. I think we have to be very careful in that regard. You know, is it a neural complex? If it's below the AV bundle, if it's a block below that bundle, it's not going to work. It's ineffective. So I think that's also one of the whole cookbook medicine types of things. And I think in this case, probably going to be ineffective, atropine is. I think cardiac pacing is warranted. But again, I think her age and what is normal for her, that's easily going to play into our decision making. So, you know, maybe in some cases, somebody may more aggressive may start pacing. Others may not. And then the other thing I want to, we never really talked about an ABG here, but this patient is probably going to be a pretty severe metabolic acidosis, obviously progressing into ARDS. And I think we talk about this in our review classes all the time, the whole sodium bicarb administration thing. And you know, we definitely have a mindset from the past. But if you read the most current literature out there, the only two life-saving uses for sodium bicarb administration in a drip form is ethylene glycol or methanol ingestion or poisoning. Those are life-saving, that is a life-saving type of treatment. In these other metabolic acidosis situations, we have to understand what's going to end up happening is you're going to convert that bicarb to CO2, right? It's just a big revolving circle. And that doesn't mean we can't go there, but to think that just giving sodium bicarb in this situation is going to fix the patient, you have to understand what is going to be the secondary effect. You're going to make more CO2. So as long as you know that and you set your minute ventilation higher and you blow off that excess, then that's fine. But what are you accomplishing, right? Maybe it is to a point just to keep her alive, right? But there's always going to be a secondary effect to that.
Yeah, and in many of those cases, I think what people do is they're going to just be trying to chase numbers, right? And that isn't going to do anybody any good. You know, you're not dealing with the problem. You're chasing numbers. So
I think this is a great case. This is a very sad case. I think there's a lot of complex concepts. And we tried to make this digestible. And hopefully you enjoyed it. If you do have any questions, comments, email Ashley at ashley.bauer@flightbridgehead.com. And she will get back to you. She loves your emails. And Mike, do you have anything left to say, Ashley?
No. I think we covered it.
I think we covered it.
All right. On behalf of Ashley and Mike, coming to you from NTI, we will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.